From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Margaret Sanger founded the modern birth control movement back when birth control was illegal in this country. After she opened her first clinic in 1916, she was arrested. Now her grandson is the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of New York City. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Alexander Sanger about how he ended up carrying on his grandmother's work. Also today, socially responsible investing. We talk with Peter Kinder, co-author of Investing for Good, about investing in the market without sacrificing your principles. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews some new recordings by conductor and composer Pierre Boulez. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Negotiators from the world's leading industrial nations said today that they're close to agreement on a plan to reduce worldwide trade barriers to be taken up at the G7 summit in Tokyo. The preliminary talks were conducted by top trade officials from the United States, Japan, Canada, and the European Community. They're looking for agreements on some of the key disputes that are holding up the GATT talks on liberalizing world trade. The negotiators will meet again in an effort to come up with a final package of agreements that their country's leaders can discuss when the summit officially begins tomorrow. The upper Mississippi River is already well over its banks, and with torrential rains continuing, Iowa disaster officials expect the river to keep rising. Mark Moran of member station WOI reports from Des Moines.
The river already crested once, but the rain just won't stop falling. The river is expected to reach another near-record crest tomorrow. Towns along the state's eastern border are bracing for the worst, and Jerry Ostendorf with Iowa Emergency Management says the only thing people in those towns can do is stand back and watch the floodwater.
Mother Nature is in control right now as far as what she's going to dump on us, and we're just playing with her hand. We have to get into flood fight, and we've got guardsmen out. We're sandbagging, we're pumping, and evacuating wherever necessary.
Rain is forecast in the region for the entire week, and more National Guard troops have been sent to the area to combat high water. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
Authorities say more than 100 people have died in political violence in black townships in South Africa following Friday's announcement of free elections next April. The combatants appear to be mostly supporters of the African National Congress and the Inkatha Freedom Party. Some of the worst fighting has been in two townships outside Johannesburg. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports.
The situation in the two townships is now described as quiet. But as darkness fell, township residents began digging trenches to keep out the hostel dwellers and police. In the several days of fighting, most of the victims have been ordinary people caught in the crossfire or murdered by one hit squad or another. Each side blames the other for starting this bloodletting, and each side threatens more violence. There are now several hundred refugees from the fighting. Most of them have lost their homes and possessions and are camping out in the grounds of churches and community halls. Their plight highlights one of the central questions in this situation, whether in the midst of violence and fear, their impending political freedom will mean anything.
Fergal Keane in Johannesburg. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 34 points to close at 3,449. The NASDAQ Composite Index was down 2.27 at 702.2. This is NPR News in Washington. Reports from Nigeria say that at least 11 people were killed today in protests against the country's military dictatorship. The Pan-African News Agency reported that most people were killed by police and soldiers, but at least two policemen were among the dead. The man who claims to have won last month's presidential election, a wealthy businessman named Moshood Abiola, urged people to resist the dictatorship of General Ibrahim Babangida. Babangida nullified the election last month, claiming vote fraud. He's threatened to dissolve the National Assembly if protests continue. France agreed today to send military advisors to Cambodia to help the new government there create a unified army. The decision came during a two-day visit to Cambodia by the French defense minister. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Defense Minister François Léotard said France would send several dozen military advisors to Cambodia to help set up a new military structure there. Cambodia's new army is to be made up of soldiers from the three main parties that led the election. Two of the parties fought together against the third during Cambodia's 13-year-old civil war, which ended with the 1991 peace accord. A fourth faction, Khmer Rouge, has been asked to turn its 10,000 troops over to the new government. French sources say the restructuring will require cutting the number of soldiers in the country by half. Léotard said France was also willing to help the country's navy and air force. He said France would leave some military equipment behind when its 1,500 UN troops leave Cambodia in the fall. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
The New York Times said today that veteran foreign correspondent and columnist Harrison Salisbury has died. He was 84. Salisbury won the Pulitzer Prize in 1955 for his reporting from the former Soviet Union. He was best known for his reporting from Moscow and from China during the Cold War. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When you hear that the president of Planned Parenthood of New York City is Alexander Sanger, the logical question is, any relation to Margaret Sanger? Well, the answer is yes. He's the grandson of Margaret Sanger, the founder of the American Birth Control Movement. When she opened America's first birth control clinic in 1916, birth control was illegal in this country. She spent most of her life trying to change the law and educate men and women about birth control. She died in 1966. We invited Alexander Sanger to talk with us about carrying on his grandmother's work and about the effect of her work on her family. Last month, Planned Parenthood of New York City initiated a new program to train medical residents and physicians in surgical abortion and counseling procedures. He told me why he thought this program was necessary.
Well, the reason we're training doctors is because the medical schools and residency programs are not. A OBGYN resident can go through 4 years of postgraduate training and never do an abortion and not have the training available to him or her. About 12% of the residency programs in the country require abortion training, and about another half have it optional, but relatively few of the residents opt for the training. So we have a whole generation of doctors becoming OBGYNs and never knowing how to perform an abortion.
Now, why do you think it's been so hard for you to find doctors to perform abortions? One reason is obviously that not that many doctors are being trained to perform the procedure. Are there other reasons?
Well, I think there are other reasons. We don't pay a lot, so I think economics enters into it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think harassment, you know, if doctors have a choice between delivering babies and doing hysterectomies and doing fertility work, that's not going to subject them or their families to harassment in restaurants or being stalked or even being shot at. So I think there's a very normal fear among a lot of young doctors. They say, who needs it? You know, why should I do this? So part of our program is to remind the young doctors why abortion was legalized in the first place. And it was legalized at the behest of the medical profession and women's groups because so many women were giving themselves abortions and dying as a result. And so we're trying to get some political motivation and education into our training program. And I think it's going to help. And the long run, I will be training, I think, maybe 30, 40, 50 doctors a year and have other programs replicated around the country.
Has Planned Parenthood of New York City been the victim of much harassment?
We get periodic harassment. Our clinic in Manhattan, a bomb was placed in it about 6 years ago. Fortunately, only the detonator went off and not the whole bomb, or the whole building would have come down. It's a 12-story building. After that, we've just been subject to the usual blockades and picketing. But it's not been as bad in New York City as in the rest of the country. I think most of the violence has been in the heartland and in the South. I attribute that to it's mostly white people in the opposition, and they are trying to stop white women from having abortions. So a city like New York and other major metropolitan centers with large minority populations, those in the opposition are don't want to target that. And all you have to do is listen to what they say and read their literature. I mean, one of the groups sent out a letter last year, and it said the white race is contracepting itself out of the mainstream. That's how these people think. It's a white supremacy group, in my view.
That's interesting. So you think there's less concern about women of color getting abortions in New York City?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the opposition has a heavy tinge of white supremacy in it. They are real extremists. This is not to say that there are not valid people with, you know, with pro-life, valid pro-life views across the spectrum of this country, racial groups and ethnic groups. But the leaders who are the extremists, all you have to do is read what they say, and their extremism comes out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alexander Sanger. He's the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of New York City. He's also the grandson of Margaret Sanger, who was the founder of the birth control movement. Alex Sanger, did you always feel connected to your grandmother's work?
My grandmother was always a presence around our house, even when she wasn't there. I grew up in suburban New York, and my grandmother was living out in Tucson, Arizona. So I didn't see her a lot as a child growing up, maybe once or twice a year. But we talked about her a lot. I knew from a very young age that she was famous, if not infamous. I knew she had gone to jail. But I knew that the people in our community, anyway, considered her perhaps the greatest woman who ever lived. And, you know, the woman who contributed most in this century to women's rights and to human rights. So I had always had that about her. I mean, I always knew that. It was part of growing up, and the belief that you know, women were entitled to equality with men. You know, back in the 50s when I was growing up, that was a fairly radical notion.
Did your mother and father believe that, and did they teach that to you?
Well,
too?
Yeah, they did, and it was really mainly even my mother, who probably had more of an influence on me than even my grandmother did. My mother was Margaret Sanger's daughter-in-law, and their relationship would probably take a full hour on your show to talk about. It was, it was quite something, those two, both competing for the attention of my father. But my mother was a doctor. She, after she got out of high school back in the late 20s, she was the only person in her class to go to college. And after college, she went to study to be a concert pianist. But her teacher, after a year and a half of study, told her that her hands were too small and she would never make it. And so that didn't stop her for long. She then decided she would become a doctor. And never having taken a science course in her life, went to summer school, took, I think, 5 or 6 science courses simultaneously, and then went to Columbia Medical School, where she was one of 5 women in her class of 120. So I had this incredible example of my mother working almost full-time when I was growing up. So it was a very supportive atmosphere for women being achievers in our family.
Now, I guess it was when you were in college, you wrote your senior thesis on Margaret Sanger?
I did. There are 2 requirements to graduate from Princeton. One is to be able to swim a lap in the pool, and the other is to have to write a senior thesis. The former was pretty easy for me, not for some of my classmates. But writing a senior thesis was a big piece of work, and I was a history major, and I decided, well, why not write about something that, you know, I knew something about and something that would interest me for a year and a half project. And as part of it, I went to see all my grandmother's letters, which are at Smith College and at the Library of Congress, and read them all and read her diaries and really began to learn about her and about what she had gone through. And about the effect on my father, which was probably the most personally devastating thing that I, you know, had to learn about, how he grew up and what he had to go through and the scars that were left on him. So I read all that and wrote a thesis. And as I tell students at Princeton, pick a thesis topic that you feel passionate about because you may end up doing it the rest of your life.
Yeah. You said that reading your grandmother's letters, you realized what a devastating effect her work had on your father. What was the devastating effect? What did you learn about that?
Well, I read, for instance, letters that my father would write home from school. He was sent to boarding school at about age 7 because my grandmother was too busy doing her work and in and out of jail to be dealing with her children. And he was first out in a boarding school on Long Island. And one letter I will never forget, it said, "Dear Mother," he always called her Mother, I walked down to the train station today. You said you'd be on the 7:30 train. You weren't there. I waited for the next 3 trains. You didn't get off. I walked back to school. When are you coming to see me? And it was letter after letter like that of broken promises. Another time, my grandmother was under indictment by the federal government, 9 counts of obscenity for publishing a newspaper called The Woman Rebel. And she actually, it's a very justified indictment because the newspaper was outrageous. It encouraged assassination, among other things, but that's another long story. But on the night before she was going to go to trial, where she was certain to lose and face 45 years in prison, she decided to skip bail and leave the country to avoid trial. So she took my father and my uncle and my aunt and left them with a neighbor. She literally walked over to a neighbor, knocked on the door, said, "Here are my children. I'm going to Europe." And she left the country for 10 months. So it's that type of thing that my father had to grow up with and learn to deal with and to cope with. And it was difficult for him. He didn't cope very well. He bore the scars throughout his life.
So he was virtually abandoned during part of his life so that your mother could do her work, so that his mother could do her work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was, if not with neighbors, left with aunts, with my grandfather's mother. She helped take care of him. So it was very traumatic.
When your father got old enough to understand the nature of his mother Margaret Sanger's work, did he believe in that work?
Oh, he believed very strongly in the work. And even though he was a doctor in private practice, he would go out and speak at Planned Parenthood when asked to after her death. And he was on the board of the Margaret Sanger Research Bureau here in New York, which was the clinic my grandmother started in 1923 here in Manhattan. So he was involved tangentially throughout his life, but he really couldn't talk about her. When I was doing my thesis, I would try to come up and talk with him, and he couldn't do it. He would change the subject. Just talking about his mother in the early days was just too difficult for him.
Is your father still alive?
No, he died about 4 years ago, and he died about a year before I took the job at Planned Parenthood. So I'm sorry he didn't live to see me do this. He would have been absolutely thrilled. I think my grandmother would be. She'd be speechless to find me at Planned Parenthood of New York City. I was never exactly my grandmother's favorite. My grandmother believed very strongly in limits and the number of children one should have. She had three herself, and she thought two or three was the right number. Well, I am the fourth of six. And when my mother was pregnant with me, I think my parents drew straws to see who was going to call my grandmother, and I think my mother got the short straw and made the phone call and said, well, Margaret, I'm pregnant again. And my grandmother responded, and I'm quoting, she said, "You have disgraced me. I'm going to Europe." And in fact, she went down and hopped on the Queen Mary and went over to Europe until after I was born. My mother had to make a similar call a few years later to announce her sixth pregnancy with my younger sister. And medical records indicate my grandmother had her first heart attack right about that time.
Oh.
So she did not was not thrilled with her son producing six children.
Do you think your parents just wanted a big family, or do you think this was in part a rebellion against Margaret Sanger?
Oh, I think it's clearly a rebellion in part about my father. My mother wanted to have a daughter, and she was going to go on until she had a daughter. And so we had five boys, and then my sister was born. But I think on my father's part, it was a way of asserting his independence.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alex Sanger. He's the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood of New York City. He's also the grandson of Margaret Sanger, the founder of the birth control movement. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Alex Sanger. He's the president of Planned Parenthood of New York City and the grandson of Margaret Sanger. What did you learn about your grandmother's reasons for starting the birth control movement and for opening a clinic in 1916? What had she seen? What had she experienced that led her to take that on as her crusade?
I think the major motivating factor was her mother. Both her parents were Irish Catholics, born in Ireland and came over here where they met and married. And my grandmother's mother was pregnant 18 times, had seven miscarriages, 11 children, and died at age 49 of tuberculosis and exhaustion from childbirth. And as a result, my grandmother had to leave school to take care of the younger children. And they grew up very poor. I was in Corning, New York recently, where they grew up. And there are literally six or seven or eight houses still standing in Corning where my great-grandfather had his home. And the reason he had so many houses was he couldn't pay the rent. And so he kept on getting bounced from house to house. So it was a pretty tough existence. And it wasn't easy to look up the hill and see the Houghton family that owned the Corning Glassworks in a big mansion on the hill, and they had two or three children. And they were very wealthy. And so my grandmother immediately made the connection between good health and better lifestyle with the number of children one had. Another factor was her father, who was a free thinker. That was the word used back in those days for someone who was a radical. And he invited people like Henry George and Ralph Ingersoll to speak in Corning. And he always imposed on my grandmother, the thought that, think for yourself, make your own decisions, do what you feel is right. And so the combination of the two left an effect on her. She became a nurse. I don't know why she decided to go into nursing. Maybe it's the only way she thought she could earn a living. Her two older sisters became maids in houses and became private secretaries. But she became a nurse, and the family helped get money together for her to be in nursing school. And then when she was working on the Lower East Side of New York, she saw women who were giving themselves abortions because they could not have any more children. And she was patching them up, and one after another died in her arms, and she finally said, enough, there's got to be a better way.
What did the law have to say about birth control when Margaret Sanger started her clinic in 1916?
The law said that any dissemination of birth control information or devices was not only against federal law but against New York law. But there was an interesting exception in New York law saying that a doctor could give a condom to a man to prevent that man from picking up a venereal disease when he went to a prostitute. That was how the law read in 1916.
Could a woman buy a condom to protect herself against a disease?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. There were condoms available. They were invented. The rubber condom was invented by Mr. Goodyear. You see his blimps over our nation's cities. And he invented one in about 1836 in his garage in Connecticut.
I didn't realize he was responsible for that.
Yep. There were earlier versions made out of, the guts of a sheep or a lamb or whatever, but this was the first synthetic rubber version. Mm-hmm. But they were available, but they were illegal. But they were available under the counter, as were various, home remedies and old wives' remedies that were passed down from generation to generation.
Your grandmother not only believed in birth control, she also believed in free love. How did the free love part of her life affect her reputation, do you think?
Well, she kept it pretty quiet. It was probably the scariest part then of her message and is still the scariest part now, which is why she arouses such violent opposition, the fact that women should be able to enjoy sex. This was a radical notion back then, and for a lot of people is radical now. And she practiced it. She had, numerous affairs with a lot of men during her career and while she was married to my grandfather and then while she was married to my second husband, her second husband. And they ranged from, people like H.G. Wells and John Reed, the famous writer. And lots of other notable people of the day. But she kept very quiet about it because she knew that if this information got out, it could destroy her. But she kept all their letters. She wrote about them in her diaries. And she left it all behind for me and other researchers to find.
Your grandmother's single-minded focus on birth control was obviously really good for the movement and not so good for her family. Trying to stand back a little bit and get a little distance on the story, what are your perceptions about the sacrifices great people make, like really people who've been very important politically or socially, the sacrifices they make personally and the sacrifices they've forced the people close to them to make?
Well, I think you have to make that decision, every person, when you're in a movement like I am and like my grandmother started, how far you're going to go, where do you draw the line, how much of a sacrifice are you going to make yourself and for your family? I keep a photograph over my desk of my grandmother with my father and my uncle taken in 1915. And my aunt is not in the picture because she had died 2 weeks earlier. The reason she had died was when my grandmother went in exile in Europe for 10 months, avoiding trial on her obscenity charges. My aunt, then age 4, missed her mother terribly, got weaker and weaker. And when my grandmother finally came back, my aunt just continued to get weaker, even though her mother was back, and died about a week after my grandmother came home of pneumonia. My grandmother then went in 2 weeks later into a photographic studio, took my father and my uncle, and had their portrait taken. And my grandmother looks totally serene and confident and dynamic in her usual way. But the faces of my father and my uncle, they are devastated. I mean, they're just totally destroyed, these two young boys, having just lost their sister. My father especially, because he and his sister were about a year apart. And so I keep that picture over my desk to remind me to get home at night, because I could do this 24 hours a day. I mean, it's a calling. You know, every person has to make that decision for themselves, and every great person who contributes anything to society, whether it's, you know, Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Abraham Lincoln, there are sacrifices. I mean, I'm not home at 5 o'clock every night, and I'm out many too many nights giving speeches or doing other things for Planned Parenthood. But I try to find a balance, and I guess everyone has to find it on their own. You know, my grandmother's determination, I saw it once, and it was a searing experience. It was the last time I saw her, actually, about 6 months before she died. We went out to the nursing home in Tucson, Arizona, over Christmas vacation to see her, and she was not well, and was, in fact, lying there in the nursing home, pretty much in a coma. And on New Year's Day, we all trooped in, my father, my mother, and all six of us children. We lined up according to height. And my father, always one for a ceremony, brought a bottle of champagne. And when he popped the cork, my grandmother popped out of her coma because she always loved a drink. And she loved a ceremony. And she heard that champagne cork go, and she said, "I want a drink." And the nurse was there in the room saying, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Sanger, you're not allowed to drink." And my grandmother said, "I want a drink," in a louder and louder voice. And finally, the head nurse heard outside and came in to try to calm things down. And my grandmother kept at it and at it. And finally, the medical director of the facility heard the ruckus all the way down in his office. He came down, and the end result was the last time I saw my grandmother, she was drinking champagne through a straw. And nothing much stopped her from things she wanted.
You are now the president of Planned Parenthood of New York City. Do you feel that you are fighting any of the same battles that your grandmother, Margaret Sanger, fought at the turn of the century?
I'm fighting all of them. I mean, not a whole lot has changed. She had problems with the fact that she couldn't speak in public about birth control. And just last year, we had the gag rule. She had to fight for getting some decent contraceptives in this country. We still don't have a decent contraceptive for every woman. She had to fight the court system and the government. We've been doing that the last 12 years. She had to fight the medical profession because doctors didn't want to get involved. And here I am training doctors in how to perform abortions. And she had to fight the religious community and the religious right and the fundamentalists in the Catholic Church, and I'm doing exactly the same. So I look back somewhat chagrined. I mean, she accomplished so much and was one of the great women of the world and of the century and of the millennium even. But, you know, I'm still fighting those battles, and maybe by the time I get done, I'll have made some more progress.
Alexander Sanger, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Alexander Sanger is president of Planned Parenthood of New York City and the grandson of Margaret Sanger. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, socially responsible investing. We talk with Peter Kinder. He says it's possible to get a high return on your money and be true to your conscience. Kinder co-created an index that measures the performance of socially responsible corporations. He's also the co-author of the new book, Investing for Good. Also, Pierre Boulez is back, conducting and recording. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews several new Boulez recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. It's Wednesday morning in Japan, and leaders of the seven large industrialized nations are in Tokyo, ready to start their 19th annual economic summit. NPR's John Edstey reports.
In past years, economic issues have often been overshadowed by political issues at these summits, but not this year. All of the leaders gathered here are presiding over economies in recession or growing very slowly, and all face abnormally high unemployment. But coming up with concrete ways to attack the problems will not be easy. The leaders will likely endorse a proposal made by both President Clinton and Japanese Prime Minister Miyazawa for a future meeting of G7 labor ministers and economic advisors to attack the problem of slow job growth. They also hope to make progress on a major portion of the GATT World Trade Treaty, which would reduce trade barriers and boost growth. This is the most concrete action the leaders could take to promote growth, but up to now, trade negotiators have not been able to hammer out the compromises necessary to get an agreement. I'm John Idstey in Tokyo.
In Nigeria, anti-government demonstrators fought with police, and government officials have given local officials in the capital 24 hours to restore order. A dozen people were reported killed in the latest violence as fires were set and roads blocked as protesters called for an end to military rule. The deaths were the first since the government annulled a presidential election that was to end years of military rule. A study in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association suggests that providing health insurance alone to pregnant women is not enough to improve their health. NPR's Joanne Silberner has this report.
Researchers from Harvard University looked at the health of new mothers in Massachusetts after the state kicked off a program that pays for health care for poor, pregnant women. The researchers measured how many medical problems the women developed and how many days they had to stay in the hospital. Women were no better off before or after the insurance program began. Earlier this year, the same researchers released another report showing that babies weren't any better off either. But the researchers caution that their findings shouldn't be taken to mean that health insurance won't help poor mothers or their babies. Instead, they suggest that health insurance won't work in a vacuum. Improvements in other areas, like health education and the quality of care, may also be necessary. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
Pilots at Northwest Airlines have given tentative approval to a concessions agreement that the company says is needed to keep it from filing for bankruptcy protection. The Airline Pilots Association says union leaders have approved the agreement after an all-night bargaining session. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 34 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News. After a two-week-long lapse, federal jury trials in civil cases have resumed after Congress approved the necessary funding. Money to pay court-appointed attorneys to defend indigent criminal defendants ran out at the end of May. A spokesman for the Administrative Office of the U.S. Court says when funding ran out, more than $7.5 million in payments to court-appointed lawyers backed up, and numerous civil cases had to be postponed. A Florida judge has ruled that an anti-abortion activist accused of shooting a Pensacola doctor is competent to stand trial for first-degree murder. From Pensacola, Phil Berger of member station WUWF reports.
In an unusual move, Judge John Parnum requested the competency hearing before allowing the case to proceed. Three experts interviewed Michael Griffin and agreed he was competent to stand trial, understood the charges, and could assist with his own defense. Griffin has said he doesn't want a public defender and had trouble finding an attorney who would agree not to use temporary insanity as a defense. As a result, Griffin says he wants to represent himself. Today, the judge reluctantly agreed and said the trial will proceed on schedule, set to begin September 20th. Griffin indicates he will argue that the killing of Dr. Gunn was justified because the doctor performed abortions. For National Public Radio, I'm Phil Berger in Pensacola, Florida.
In parts of the Middle West, efforts continue to keep high waters from creating more flood damage, but there's also been more heavy rain, forcing more people out of their homes and causing heavy damage to farmland. Weather forecasters are predicting rain again this week, adding to the worst flooding there since 1965. Some of the heaviest flooding is in the Davenport, Iowa area, where the Mississippi appeared to have crested yesterday. But more heavy rain in Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota is expected to cause the river to rise again. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The purpose of investing in the stock market is to make money. But there's a growing number of investors who have a second goal, to encourage the growth of socially responsible companies. My guest Peter Kinder is the co-author of a new book about this growing movement called Investing for Good. Kinder is a partner in Kinder Leidenberg Domini & Company, which provides information to investors on socially responsible corporations and their performance in the market. He told me about the social criteria he uses to evaluate corporations.
Well, we screen under a number of headings. The headings that we screen under are South Africa, alcohol, tobacco, gambling, military weapons, nuclear power. We screen for product quality and consumer relations, environmental performance, corporate citizenship, employee relations, and employee diversity.
Now, South Africa, is that, you know, the boycott's been lifted and everything. Why are you still screening for South Africa?
We will screen for South Africa until Mr. Mandela says that he would like the sanctions lifted. He has not indicated that. And until he does, we will continue to screen on South Africa.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of conflicting impulses you'd probably have if you're trying to find socially conscious companies to invest in. And in your previous book on ethical investing, I think you gave a really good example of a typical dilemma someone might be in. This was the story of a woman who was advised to drop a drug company stock because they invest in South Africa. And she said, "No way, this company makes my insulin. I'm diabetic."
That's right. That's right. There are many dilemmas of that type. We try to represent in the Domini Social Index the broadest range of screens, but in reality, people are very selective about those screens in their own personal portfolios. And you'll also see that the social funds run the gamut of broadly screened funds to ones that have fairly narrow focuses. For example, the New Alternatives Fund really looks at new environmental technologies. The Green Century Fund has very rigorous environmental screens. And you will see in over the next year other funds that will address particular niches in the social investment movement.
You've been writing about socially conscious investing for over a decade, I think. Well, under a decade, I guess.
Almost exactly.
We've narrowed it down. Almost exactly a decade. and I know you're up on something of the history of socially conscious investing. Do you see a big shift in what kinds of screens are being used, or, you know, what the criteria have been?
Oh, yes. Oh, there's been a dramatic shift. When we first got into this field, and actually I should say that my wife, Amy Domini, got into this field long before I did.
Mm-hmm.
But when she started out, the only screens that really were implementable were ones that were negative, that you could identify the, say, 10 largest emitters of toxic chemicals. You could identify the worst of the forest product companies. You could identify the top 100 military weapons contractors. So the screens were really negative. What has happened over particularly the last 5 to 6 years is that investors, while they still will apply those negative criteria, are really looking for positive stories. They're looking for the companies that really make a difference in society. For example, Nordstrom's has one of the best records of hiring women in line positions and in their executive suite. The companies like ISCO Products, which provide environmental measuring devices for pollution control, and also have superb records of hiring the handicapped. Those are the kinds of companies that social investors are now looking for.
How did you get involved in socially conscious investing?
I met my wife. She was then a broker, and she had been interested in socially responsible investing for some time. I come from a legal background and had been trained that if one did not like a company's management or policies, one sold the stock.
I thought you were going to say one sued.
No. in those days, one had far fewer grounds to sue. But no, it was that you had the Wall Street rule, which is if you didn't like management, you sold. Mm-hmm. That was all there was to it. And frankly, when Amy introduced me to this concept, I thought it was crazy. I did not see the potential for it. Didn't see how you could influence corporate social behavior. And she strongly convinced me otherwise, primarily by introducing me to the shareholder activists. And with that piece of information, it suddenly all made sense to me. Because in Professor David Vogel's phrase, and I wish I could claim this for myself, what we're really up to is lobbying the corporation. And the only way you can lobby a corporation effectively is to own part of it. And that is the role of the shareholder activists. We ourselves are continually asking corporations, and I mean this on a daily basis, we'll be talking to anywhere upwards of 20 or 30 corporations. We are raising with them the questions that our investors are concerned about. Hiring policies, environmental policies, product quality issues. So we are really politics by other means.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Kinder, co-author of the new book, Investing for Good, Making Money While Being Socially Responsible. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Kinder. We're talking about socially conscious investing. He's the co-author of the new book, Investing for Good. Tell me if you hear this a lot. The purpose of investing is to make money. It's not to affect social change or to further your political agenda. It's to make money. So you just look at the companies that have the best performance data and you invest in those, and it's foolish to bring in the whole idea of social issues into investing.
First, I think there is no reason why you can't accomplish both goals. In our studies, we've seen every indication that you can. Secondly, I think it's very important to understand that money is not separate and apart from the rest of your life. Money is an integral part of your life. What you do with it has consequences not just for who you are and what your objectives are. They have larger consequences. And if you really are concerned about an issue like the environment, like employee relations, like diversity in the workplace, why not put your money to work to further those objectives?
Well, the answer to that question would be from the people who don't think this is an effective way to make money, is that the social investing doesn't have as good performance record as just, plain old investing for profits. What data do you have on that?
Our data comes from the Domini Social Index, which in its 3 years in existence has performed better than the Standard & Poor's 500, which is the generally accepted benchmark for large capitalization portfolios, large stock portfolios. That's preliminary data. We have not been through a full market cycle from boom to bust to boom. But there have been other studies which indicate the same thing. There is no necessary give back to the market, if you will, for investing according to your principles.
You mentioned the Domini Social Index. This is something that you co-created with your wife, Amy Domini. What is it?
We realized 4 years ago, 5 years ago now, that we were getting a question every time we went out to talk, and that was, if social investing is such a good idea, where are your numbers? And we could point to Amy's numbers. We could point to her employer's numbers. But there was no outside benchmark like the Standard & Poor's 500 or the Dow Jones Industrials that showed how a social portfolio would perform over time. So we set out to create one. And what the Domini Social Index does is measure the performance of a broadly screened market basket of stocks, 400 companies, over time. And our index is particularly designed to establish those types of numbers for socially screened portfolios. And the reason for that is that large segments of the Standard & Poor's 500 are not suitable, not acceptable to social investors. For example, Philip Morris and the tobacco stocks, Circus Circus and the gaming stocks, Seagram's and the alcohol stocks, the nuclear power companies. These are not companies that are going to appear in a social portfolio. And they figure largely, in fact, the only utilities on the Standard & Poor's 500 are nuclear. So it's simply not an appropriate benchmark. That's why we set out to create it.
Tell me the other reasons why you decided to create a social index.
The primary reason was that we felt that we had a responsibility to create the same kinds of financial indices and financial data that other investment professionals had. We wanted to make social investing professional, if you will. We wanted to give it all of the attributes of other disciplines in the investment field. And we're working in other areas as well.
What are some of the companies that are now on the Domini Social Index? And how did they get there? What are some of the things that they've done that you've approved of that have, you know, landed them on your list?
Well, we've given some of the examples. So I can give you a couple of examples of controversial companies that are on our list. Amoco has been on our list. They have been extremely active in community development. They make loans for low-income housing. They've invested in low-income housing. They have an extraordinary corporate giving program. That's on the positive side. On the negative side, they do not have the best environmental record in the world. But we felt on balance that Amoco belonged in our index.
It was that controversial because a lot of people assume that no oil company would be on a socially conscious index?
There are people who take that position. Mm-hmm. There are two views on that. One is a kind of best of the industry view that you mm-hmm. take the best, assuming that there is a best. Mm-hmm. For example, I think it would be hard. You'd be hard pressed to come up with a best strip mine company, but you take the best of the industry, or you take the view that the industry itself is inherently bad, and therefore you will not invest in it. And both find expression in social investing.
Mm-hmm.
Another company that I think is particularly good is Herman Miller. This is a furniture manufacturer. They have remarkable employee relations and employee participation in decision-making, profit-sharing, and the like. Hewlett-Packard is also controversial, but they too have very strong employee relations and very strong product quality controls.
With Amoco, which you said was a pretty controversial choice for your list, cynical people might say, well, they have a bad environmental record, and sure, they're involved in doing some community good. That's public relations. They have to do that to boost their image. And, you know, you're being a sucker and falling for it. The cynical view.
Well, if that wasn't backed up by Amoco's dollars going into the community, I probably would subscribe to that. But what they do is tangible. You can evaluate it. You can see it. And the people who are in the community verify it. We make great efforts to verify corporate claims. We do not accept them at face value. However, you're touching on something I think that's very important, and that is I don't mind corporations wrapping themselves in the environmental movement, and I don't mind them saying we have great community relations and asserting that, because that sets a standard by which I'm certainly going to come back and ask them questions. So I think that corporations who wrap themselves in these issues and assert their virtue are setting standards by which they're going to be judged. I think that's all to the good.
Mm-hmm. Peter Kinder, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Peter Kinder is co-author of Investing for Good. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton is in Tokyo for an economic summit. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on that on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing from John Itzde, our economics reporter, who is also in Tokyo for the Group of Seven summit. It begins tomorrow. He'll be reporting on what's likely to happen there. Also, President Clinton arrives in Tokyo with Japanese politics in some chaos. Prime Minister Miyazawa is a lame duck. There's an election in 2 weeks. We'll be hearing from an expert on Japanese politics about what might happen in that new election and whether it might really change Japanese politics and policies, and a special report, Nina Totenberg, on Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her career as a federal appeals court justice.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. About 10 years ago, the distinguished French conductor and composer Pierre Boulez said he wanted to cut back on conducting and concentrate on his own compositions. Lately, though, he's been returning to America to conduct the Cleveland Symphony and the Chicago Orchestra. He's also been making records again. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is not unhappy about this.
Pierre Boulez may be our greatest living conductor, so it's good news that he's back in the recording studio. And since he's also our greatest advocate of 20th century music, it's also good news that he's been taking a new look at the music he's most associated with. Deutsche Grammophon has released 3 new discs of Stravinsky, Bartok, and Debussy that are full of subtle but distinctly audible new insights. Maybe best of all is the Debussy album. Boulez once called Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of a Faun, which was first performed in 1894, the work with which modern music awakes. I thought Boulez's first recording of this in 1968 lived up to his reputation for being cool and analytical. But listen to the lovingly sinuous flute solo that opens the new recording with the Cleveland Orchestra. This is Boulez at his very best. Not only does he let you hear every note, he also lets you hear exactly why Nijinsky's overtly erotic choreography would have caused such a scandal. The other pieces on the new album are sexy in different ways. The three orchestral images are among Debussy's most exhilarating and colorful works. The longest and most famous section is the three-movement Iberia, with its supersaturated cinemascope suggestions of Spanish streets and byways, sensual night perfumes, and a festive holiday morning. Debussy was captivated by Spanish rhythms and harmonies, which he expressed in his daringly original orchestrations. Who would guess that he had only spent a few hours in Spain? Besides these new Deutsche Grammophon discs, the Erato label has been issuing music that Boulez never commercially recorded before, including some of his own compositions, Schoenberg's early and highly romantic symphonic poem, Pelléas and Mélisande, and the complete one-act Stravinsky opera, The Nightingale. Other labels have been releasing live performances of Boulez's astonishing Mahler, Schumann, and even Brahms. And Boulez's old label, Sony, has been reissuing some of Boulez's greatest hits on its new Boulez edition. Welcome back, Pierre Boulez.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and the author of the collection of poems Goodnight, Gracie. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Sue Weinstein, Nancy Greenlease, and Robbie Harris. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Anna Deavere Smith went to Los Angeles after the riots and interviewed people. That's the basis of her theater piece, Twilight. It's a series of monologues in which she becomes the people she interviewed, including Rodney King's aunt, Reginald Denny, Daryl Gates, and a Korean store owner. On the next Fresh Air, she performs excerpts of her show. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.